Welcome to WebRush, the weekly talk show that brings you stories of real-world development from industry experts and developers like you and me. Each week, Ward Bell, Dan Wallin, Craig Shoemaker, and John Papa find out what it takes to write, deploy, and maintain apps that stand up to the demands of the real world. And now, here are your hosts.
Welcome back to WebRush. This week's episode is 140, all about Blazor. And I like to say it like that, you know, Blazor. Reminds me of that Dodgeball movie out there. It's where all the people are named like Blazor, Razor, Phaser, and things like that. But so I'm John Papa, and today I've got Dan Wallin and Craig Shoemaker along with me, and we're going to talk about Blazor and ASP.NET and WASM and all this other fun stuff that we can do in the browser that's a little bit off of our normal topics here. But hey, it's all the web, and we want to see where this thing's going to lead us. And today's episode, we've got a special guest that, Dan, we've known this guest for a while.
Years. And years and years, but we haven't seen him in years.
Way back to the days of what now? What technology was that, Dan?
It was like the technology should, I think we call it the technology that shall not be uttered or something like that.
Something
might be called Silverlight.
Oh, yeah. Silverlight or WPF Plus. Wasn't that like the original name?
Wasn't it WPF Silverlight, Everywhere?
I think it was.
Yeah. Something like this. Yeah, it was. Oh, my gosh. Now, half the listeners.
I think it was WPF Rainbows.
Rainbows.
Right. WPF Rainbows.
It was Rainbows and Unicorns back in the days of Flash and all that fun stuff. But
oh, my God, Flash.
So, Michael Washington, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And for those of you out there who are not familiar with Michael, let me tell you a little bit about him. Michael Washington is an ASP.NET C# programmer. He has extensive knowledge in process improvement, building systems, and student information systems. He's the founder of BlazorHelpWebsite.com and AIHelpWebsite.com. He has a son, Zachary, and resides in Los Angeles with his wife, Valerie. Welcome to the show, Michael. How you doing?
Okay, I'm doing great.
So you have a long history of building web applications, web technologies. We've known each other for over a decade now, on and off. Through conferences and social media and whatnot. Tell us, first of all, what is it about, I mean, what is Blazor and what is it about Blazor that attracted you to it?
Blazor is just a technology that allows you to build modern, and I'm doing air quotes there.
Yeah, they can all see them, by the way, through the audio. Oh, yeah.
But modern web applications. So essentially the same applications that you would build if you were using the other modern frameworks such as Angular, React. The difference is that you use a lot less JavaScript, but the most important thing, for myself at least, is that it does not require the use of a Node Package Manager, which is my... It hates me. So
hey, it's all of us, Michael. Yeah. You're not alone.
So essentially that's what it is. You know, I was really involved with Angular. I love TypeScript. I actually love Angular as a language. But I got involved with Blazor simply because it allowed me to remove that whole NPM part out of it. And still code my web applications using primarily just C# code and HTML. So C# and HTML, that's pretty much what a Blazor app is comprised of. There is a whole Blazor WebAssembly versus Blazor server, and we can get into that, but the elevator pitch is pretty much that.
I don't think we've talked a ton. We might have had an episode, I don't remember, Craig, on WebAssembly, but walk us through. So, you know, we're all used to maybe TypeScript and then compiling that down to JavaScript, but you're talking full on C# here. So how's that play into the browser? Walk for maybe people that haven't heard of WebAssembly and things, walk us through that.
So in my opinion, WebAssembly is a plugin. I know you're supposed to say it is not a plugin. To me, WebAssembly is a plugin. It's just a plugin that is the industry standard. So therefore, you know, it's not treated like the plugins of the technology which shall not be named Silverlight or Flash. But so if anyone has you know, is used, you know, knows of the plugins. WebAssembly just, you know, runs like that. So therefore, Blazor allows you to write C-sharp code that then runs as a WebAssembly application, and it can therefore make calls into your backend code or run offline. and it runs. So that's Blazor WebAssembly. However, Blazor has two different modes. The other mode of Blazor is probably the equivalent of running a server-side JavaScript program. And it allows you to run that exact same code. So that's why they used to have two names, but then they went back to one name, a Blazor. And it runs the Blazor code not in WebAssembly in a pseudo plugin, but server-side exactly the way, say, an MVC or, dare I say, WebForms app would run. That mode, which is called Blazor server-side, is the mode that I use primarily. It is extremely fast. It also takes a lot less code because, you know, it's running on the server, so you don't have to, you know, write separate controllers and then protect the controllers and then have, you know, a lot of code in between. So when people are talking about Blazor, what they're talking, you have to also ask them, well, what mode are you running it in? However, the Blazor code would be the same. The only real difference if you're running in WebAssembly and you have a server backend is you would have to have the code that you would, say, for example, put in a normal Angular or React app where you have controller methods and you're calling into those controller methods and that sort of thing.
So, John, one of the things I like about AG Grid, which is a data grid component for the kind of complex grid scenarios that we encounter all the time in enterprise apps. One of the things I really like about it is that it works for a variety of frameworks, Angular, React, Vue, or just vanilla JS. Does that ring a bell for you?
Oh, it really does. There's all these different companies that I work with where they have no choice but to use a lot of these different tools because they have different teams working on them. So being able to port their code or share that code and that technical investment they have is really important to them.
Yeah, well, it's important to us. Ideally, we're a consulting company, and we never know what our client's going to want to use, Angular, React, or Vue, but they're all going to need a grid, and it's great to be able to reach for the one grid that works everywhere, AG Grid.
You know, at any size company, too, because you could have these teams that maybe they only use one framework, but eventually they're going to switch to another one and be able to take that investment again and use it, reuse it is really nice.
So if a multi-framework grid makes sense to you, you should certainly go over there and check out AG Grid at ag-grid.com and tell them Warden John sent you.
So if we were to kind of zoom out for a second and say, okay, there's certainly the environment, language, and tooling sort of differentiation. Is there a higher reason or a different reason that people might want to select Blazor rather than just going with React, Angular, Svelte, or whatever?
The number one, so I got involved in Blazor when it first came out. So Steve Sanderson, Microsoft employee, who also, he's known for creating Knockout JS. So one of the first, JavaScript frameworks. And when he started working for Microsoft, he created this thing called JavaScript Services, which allowed people to easily integrate the frameworks like Angular and React with Visual Studio. So when he came out with Blazor, he basically was saying, hey guys, I have a way to kind of create, modern apps, but just using primarily C# code. So I've been involved with it for a long time. So therefore, to answer your question, the number one reason when I talk to other people who do like business apps, like my day job is to do mostly, internal, though some external, primarily business applications. Blazor allows us to make the applications much faster because it's a lot less code. It allows us to train developers faster because we literally can take anyone who knows C# and a little bit of HTML and they're up and running. I've trained a number of people in, say, for example, Angular, and there's so much I have to train the person on, the TypeScript, also, of course, HTML, but also all that back-end stuff, you know, and again, the NPM and the installing of things, and, oh, this is what, you know, the package file looks like, and this is, oh, this file, and, you know what I'm saying? There's so much more to, I feel, the other frameworks. With Blazor, it's like I said, it's like an MVC app or a web forms app, which is, here, write some code, hit F5 if you're using, say, Visual Studio. Look, the thing popped up. See, you want to make a button? Put the button here. Put the method that says, you know, hello world here. Hit F5. See, it came up. You see, it's just a lot less code. Therefore, it's faster. It's easier training. And we all know there's so many developers who started off with web forms in MVC that are still around trying to make a living. So it allows those people to make modern web
apps. What you're saying is, in order to avoid JavaScript fatigue, you just write in C sharp.
Yeah. However, it is very important to note that with Blazor, you can use JavaScript. There's obviously still a lot of JavaScript. For example, a lot of my blog posts, if you go to them, you'll constantly see me showing how to integrate, for example, Power BI. That's JavaScript. A lot of the components from, say, Syncfusion, Radzen, again, a lot of those have a lot of JavaScript. So you're not free of JavaScript. However, Blazor allows us to integrate JavaScript the way we would back with, say, web forms, you know, where you can wrap it into like a nice wrapper. And then the person consuming your component, they don't have to worry about the JavaScript. The component person, they did the JavaScript. However, obviously, you can still do your own custom JavaScript when needed. But trust me, it's a lot less. I say the average project, the amount of custom JavaScript that we have to implement, even on a pretty big, large application, is probably less than 5%, maybe even lower than that, especially now that there's so many components out there now.
Yeah. Now, how does it work, though? You mentioned earlier when you started explaining Blazor in general that, you know, you have the typical suspects, HTML, CSS, stuff like that. But you mentioned C Sharp. So let's kind of go to the next level here. I now have some data, and it sounds like I can write C Sharp to get it, which is nice. But what's going to be this process now to get it into the form, the data grid, whatever it is you're filling out? Because with React, you know, we have very specific data binding syntax. With Angular, it's very specific. So is it similar to that? Are we going to be doing some data binding, or how does that process work?
So remember, you're always talking about two different ones. So if it's Blazor server, I would say you construct it the way you would do your MVC app, and boom, you know. If it's Blazor WebAssembly, which is running more like a React or an Angular app, when your C-sharp running in WebAssembly, you know, makes the calls to the controller and gets back this JSON, when it, at that point, obviously, your presentation is going to be HTML. This is one of the things where Steve Sanderson, I feel, is a genius. It must have come from, you know, him starting, you know, Knockout or whatever. The binding. So, you know, John and Dan, we all go back to iNotify property change, right?
I remember that, yeah.
Steve Sanderson, you know, it's like he kind of goes, yeah, no. So he basically said, hey, just put your, you want to bind to something? You know, put the collection or the variable in the HTML, put a little at symbol so, you know, we know that it's programming stuff. You know, again, pretty much like you would do for an MVC. And the binding's going to work. Someone makes a change to something, he's going to automatically tell you that this was changed. I mean, you really need to, if you haven't experienced it, but you do know of bindings and why you have to have bindings and iNotify property change. If you look at just a basic Hello World Blazor app and just play with it, just go, I'm going to change this value here. And everything just automatically updates. And you're like, wow.
Is that using the Razor syntax?
So,
you're talking about that app?
Yeah, right. That's why Blazor is a play on Razor.
Okay, yeah.
See?
I should have known that by now.
Can you explain a little bit to folks, like, what's a Blazor? What's a Razor? What's an iNotify property? Because, like, if you're not familiar with the world, where that kind of comes from, I'm sure those names are kind of foreign to folks.
Yeah. So basically, you know, the people go back to the WPF, Silverlight, Slash stuff, whatever. You know, you bring back some data from the server, and before you pull it up into the presentation layer, you know, you kind of feel some sort of object, and that object, you know, you bind things to the presentation layer. For example, with WPF Silverlight, it's using XAML. But then when the person hits a key, you know, it's like, I need to somehow tell the code that this changed. So we have this, you know, interface that we implement back with Silverlight and WPF, you know, iNotify property change, and you wire up some things to it. With Blazor, you just have that object or that variable or that thing. And if somebody changes something on the UI layer, either by clicking a button or, you know, dragging a dial, or, you know, a thing, or even a programmatic change, it's just the things that are, you know, programmatically connected to it. For example, a label could be connected to a text box. A person types their name, and then the label automatically updates that says, "Hi, Michael," as you type in Michael in the text box. It just happens automatically.
Michael, you mentioned, just to kind of set the stage for folks, you mentioned when we're talking about Blazor, I'm trying to kind of paint a picture for folks who, a lot of our audience does web. That's what the show's all about. But right, so HTML, CSS, JavaScript, no problem. But when we get into doing something like WASM, WebAssembly, which Blazor is a form of, I think there's two important pieces here. One, Blazor uses something called a Blazor server that you mentioned. So I think that's a new piece to the puzzle that, you know, if we're just hosting something on a static site in a CDN, we don't have a server. So it'd be interesting for you to talk about what that is and what role it plays. And then also just WebAssembly in general. Like, I mean, a lot of folks have heard of it. And some folks have used it and some folks haven't. Could you explain a little bit first? Let's start with, like, what is WebAssembly and what need does it fill and what need does it not fill?
So I think we'll do in two parts. First, the WebAssembly or clients, sometimes called a client-side Blazor, and then server-side Blazor. So WebAssembly, client-side Blazor, the one that people are probably talking about when people go, oh, Blazor, it simply allows you to code an application in C# and have it run in the web browser. So WebAssembly is just it's an industry standard. It's just a shell. The majority of applications out there in the world, the WebAssembly applications out there in the world are not Blazor apps, okay? They are written in other languages because WebAssembly will run applications written in, I think, any number of languages. So Blazor is just one more language that allows you to compile it into a WebAssembly module and then send it out there, and it runs, you know, distribute it the way you would distribute, say, a JavaScript. But instead of it running in the JavaScript, in your web browser's JavaScript executable thing, it runs as a WebAssembly thing.
To connect the dots for people, like, in JavaScript, if I want to get a reference to an element in HTML, I have to do document get element by ID or, you know, query selector. Are you doing a similar type of thing in your WebAssembly code? Is it a completely different API? Is it something that people will recognize? What does that look like to bridge the gap between?
Right. So Blazor does have some APIs that allow you to talk back and forth with the JavaScript running, also that's running, you know, in the web browser at the time, other elements that are on the page at the time. However, it is also generating its presentation layer. so that would be considered part of the Blazor app, not communicating outside For example, like, you know, if I did an Angular app, you know, I've got, if I have a text box that's written in Angular, while it's, that's running on the web browser, it's considered part of my Angular app. So same thing okay. with Blazor. If I say, here's a text box, here's a button that I written, wrote in Blazor, that's considered part of my Blazor app.
So it's all contained within that, so, that execution context of WebAssembly, and you're not like going out and talking HTML and coming back in and creating HTML elements on the fly.
You okay. can. I was going to say you can, but for the most part, you know, gotcha. You wouldn't okay. have to.
And that gets into that 5% you talked about earlier, right? Which I know was just an
yeah. estimate. Right. Right.
You're not having to go outside of the bounds of Blazor and C# too often. I would assume, I don't know, maybe a custom plugin or something, a custom component you want to use that's not part of Blazor. Maybe you have to, I view it as almost like shelling out. You know, I have to shell out to another part of the program, which is not what you're doing. You're just doing interop.
Right. That's actually what it's called. It's called the Blazor JavaScript interop.
Right, right. And that's nice because, you know, the cognitive kind of overhead, as you started off earlier, sounds like it's greatly minimized because if you're good at C# and you know at least the basics of how to build these apps, you can build Blazor apps. Is that accurate to say?
Yes, exactly. But now let's talk about server-side Blazor. So for that, I would basically say take a web forms app or an MVC app. Now get rid of the postbacks. There, you're done. That's it. I'm serious. And it's more web forms than MVC. You know, a kind of, because it's Razor, it's, you would say MVC, it's really like web forms. Whereas, you know, like a web forms app, you know, you could put a button, right? And you go, okay, on click of this button, you know, change this value to hello world. And then you have a label bound to that value and it runs. That's pretty much like Blazor. The difference is there was no postbacks. What's happening under the cover with Blazor Server is they use SignalR. So when a Blazor Server app runs, there's this line of, if you look at the, you know, at the, you know, view source, you'll see a line that says it's a JavaScript. It's calling a JavaScript. You're like, whoa, whoa, what's this JavaScript? What it does is it sets up this layer, this you know, loader where basically has a connection with SignalR. So when a person, so when they need the screen to show your button and your label, they basically paint the screen, you know, paint the DOM with a button and a label. When a person clicks on it, SignalR, they actually send a SignalR thing to the server. Oh,
okay, and, Michael, I have to interrupt you. Okay. You've mentioned SignalR 5 times. I need you to share with everybody, what is SignalR?
Okay, sorry. SignalR, it's, again, a Microsoft technology that allows for communication using special protocols, very efficient protocols.
Basically WebSockets, right?
WebSockets, right. Yeah, in some cases, but then of course, you know, it can degrade into other ones, but primarily WebSockets.
That's true.
Right, primarily WebSockets.
Fallbacks, yep.
And so it's a way, so even though the person is not doing traditional postbacks, and when I say a postback, I meant, you know, like, for example, an MVC app, if you click on a button, it truly post, you know, to the server. The server figures out what the page needs to look like and then returns the entire page. It repaints the entire page, you know, to the user. With Blazor, when I click on that button, it calls, you know, makes a WebSocket connection, you know, call through SignalR. The Blazor, you know, on the server, it figures out what the diff of the page is, like what changes on the page. Oh, the person clicked this button. I need to say hello world in this label. And it sends back to this JavaScript that's running on the page. Hey, in the label, just the label, change it to say hello world. And that layer of JavaScript, again, it's that is written by the Blazor team. So, you know, you don't have to write that JavaScript. But it is JavaScript that's running. It paints the screen to say, hello world. So there wasn't a traditional postback, but there was communication from your web browser to the server and back. So that's the difference between Blazor Server. Whereas if that exact same application were running in WebAssembly, all that interaction would have happened in the WebAssembly application running in the browser. It would not have to have communicated back to the server. And so therefore, the only time that that application would need to communicate back to the server, if it was, for example, trying to get data. So, you know, if it's, if I had the button, when I clicked on the button, I need to go to the server and pull, say, the latest weather reports, then it would make a traditional call to server-side controllers, whether it's ASP.NET or .NET Core, or even you can have some other sort of backend that it can communicate with, and then it will return the data, usually JSON, or obviously there we have our new protocols that I think gRPC, Blazor also works with those new protocols also.
So what if you had a API server somewhere? Maybe you've got serverless functions out there, or you're setting some public API, et cetera. What do you need with Blazor to do that?
Oh, it would work fine. So at that point, you could, for example, use Blazor WebAssembly, but Blazor Server would also work. But let's say, for example, you can use Blazor WebAssembly, and it can communicate with your, you know, backends services, whether they're REST-based or you
because
know, anything.
You just need the client then. You don't need the Blazor server unless, this is a question, sorry.
Okay.
I'm assuming from what you're saying, you don't need the Blazor server unless you have some kind of backend processing that you need to have happen. For example, you didn't have an API server and you needed to create your own kind of thing. But if I already have my own API server somewhere or they're cloud hosted, I could get away with just using the WebAssembly client piece of it.
Yes, right.
Okay. I'm just trying to figure out the differentiation between when do you, as a person sitting down to learn this, when do you know, okay, you're always going to need the client side, right? Because you're building it in the client side. That's something to touch. But when do you also need the server piece of Blazor?
It's so weird. And it's kind of, what I usually tell people is start off with Blazor server. It's easy to understand. And like I said, it follows the, you know, MVC/WebForms model. Great. You're great. So therefore, the real question is, okay, this is working. Why am I using Blazor WebAssembly? The number one reason for needing to use Blazor WebAssembly is if you need your app to work offline. So for example, if you're doing a mobile app, and Blazor works great as, you know, mobile, like a, you know, runs as like a, you know, you construct it so it works well on mobile stuff. If you need the app to work, you know, offline where it's not connected, you know, it may not be connected to a server, backend server, but it still needs to run, then you must use a Blazor WebAssembly.
Is the Blazor server not just an API then, but it's also rendering pages with what you called Razor as well?
Yeah, because like I said, it's just like an MVC app. An MVC app doesn't work offline.
An MVC that serves pages, yes, because MVC can also serve APIs too, like any kind of data. So, okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to make sure I understand that the difference between the server and the client piece, I guess, of the Blazor WebAssembly. The server piece can be your API or it could be your thing that serves the pages. How does that differ from any traditional server-based rendering, PHP, Java server, Ruby, or just ASP.NET MVC?
Oh, it doesn't. So honestly, the difference is no postbacks. So if you're a PHP developer and you're like, okay, I'm used to making my pages like this, I'm saying the difference between, you know, if you recreate that app in Blazor versus the way you had it running in PHP is in Blazor, there's no postbacks. When people click on buttons, stuff changes.
No reloads, in other words, right?
Yeah, no reloads. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, what about SEO?
Oh, Blazor server does SEO great because, you know, it looks like a normal web page the search engines. However, the search engines, all of them, both Bing and Google, have been updated so that if you do have a WebAssembly app, and what it looks like to the search engines is when they scan the page, they see, a line of code that says, load this WebAssembly, you know, they will load that WebAssembly and they'll index the WebAssembly. So therefore, a WebAssembly app actually has really good SEO. The Blazor server apps already have a good SEO because, you know, they're like a normal MVC page. So yeah, SEO, the last time I really looked at that situation, looks great. It's not an issue. And I know, of course, obviously with in the earlier days of Angular and stuff like that, we did have a huge SEO, you know, issue.
Oh, no, I was just digesting the whole SEO thing because that was, like you're saying, a big problem for Flash, for Silverlight, for the early frameworks. So, yeah.
So, yeah, they jumped on the, for whatever reason, the search engines jumped on the SEO on the WebAssembly. So it's not just Blazor.
Right.
It's any WebAssembly, they will index them.
Yeah, and that's where server-side rendering and these other engines, Nuxt, Next, Angular Universal, Gatsby. These days, we've got plenty of options, where in the old days, really the only thing that I found stable for SEO, when I say the old days, 10 years ago.
Yeah, yesterday.
Yeah, 10 years ago with this client-side rendering stuff was tools like pre-render. IO, which was a service where you could do your own pre-render server, for example. But yeah, it wasn't pretty SEO about a decade ago. Gotten much better. And some folks might be wondering, well, why do we care about SEO? Well, if you're doing an internal app, you probably don't, and you probably shouldn't care about SEO at all. But if you're building a public website and you actually want people to search for it and find your app, your site, then, you know, if that's how your company makes money, it's probably a good idea to think about that.
Are you building a web application? Need to deliver it soon and don't have the people to do it? Maybe you're not sure your company has the skill set or experience to do it. And maybe we can help. I'm your host, Ward Bell, and my day job is building applications for companies like yours. I don't do it alone. I'm president of IdeaBlade, a consultancy that specializes in enterprise web application development. We're particularly strong in Angular, RxJS, NGRX Redux on the front end, and .NET and Microsoft technologies on the server. We're a small, tight-knit group of people handpicked by me for their expertise, experience, integrity, and team spirit. Maybe we can help you with architectural guidance and hands-on development. And if there's something we don't know, and in our field, really, there's too much to know, we can draw on our personal connections in the Microsoft RD, MVP, and Google GDE networks, as well as our international circle of really great developers, people we know and trust personally. If you got a project that's keeping you up at night, shoot us an email at info@ideablade.com. That's info@ideablade.com. And now back to the show.
Hey, Michael, how easy is it to get started? I know you've mentioned Visual Studio, but I work on Mac a lot. And so, you know, there is Visual Studio for Mac, and I'm sure you can probably do Blazor on that. I haven't actually tried that, but you know, I use VS Code, for example. I do have the .NET CLI installed, so I'm assuming, can I do the similar type thing? Can I do a .NET new Blazor or something to kick this off?
Oh yeah, it works. Yep. It works great. So it works, totally fine in, a Visual Studio Code. And I'm thinking, there's even some online websites you can go to where you can code up Blazor in a web browser, because like I said, it's very little code. And I'm trying to think, I think I remember something in Azure where you can kind of go, you know, a new app in Azure and it'll create like a client side, a Blazor app. But the Visual Studio Code, it works just fine. So if you go to blazor.net, and there should be a getting started link, and there should be a link to do your Hello World, you know, Blazor app in both, of course, Visual Studio and, of course, Visual Studio Code and, of course, Visual Studio Code for the Mac. So, yeah, Hello World and Blazor is very easy to, you know, very easy to do and complete. Also, Microsoft Learn, as a Microsoft MVP, I should point out that Microsoft Learn does have a number of modules. So that is actually where I would send someone first, is to go to Microsoft Learn, put in Blazor, and start there.
So, Michael, you've given us a really good understanding of, like, what is Blazor, what isn't it, where does it fit, kind of how do these things relate to the technologies that a lot of folks are familiar with in the web, because WebAssembly is newer. It's not new, but it's newer on the block than some of these others. But what are you building? Like, what are you doing with Blazor these days? Tell us kind of what you're deep into.
So in my day job, you know, building mostly internal apps, though we do have some widely used more public apps, we're pretty much just doing all Blazor apps. So, and we've been doing it for years. So it definitely holds up there. In my private, you know, GitHub life, I'm now primarily, of course, I'm doing all Blazor, but I'm primarily involved with Octane. It's spelled O-Q-T-A-N-E.
So of course it is.
Of course, yes.
For SEO reasons.
And it's got that little Blazor. It's like a, yeah, it's a Blazor. Yeah, it's cool logo and the whole thing. This is a project that was started by Sean Walker. Sean Walker, as many of you may know, is was the creator of .NET Nuke, which is a project that I got involved with years ago, and that's actually the reason why I was able to get my my initial Microsoft MVP involvement there.
Brings back memories.
So
I haven't heard that in a long time.
Yeah, exactly. No, but it's so funny. It's the same cast of characters, and they're involved with Octane. So basically, Octane is built by the same people to do the same thing as .NET Nuke, but the difference is it's in Blazor. So, and back with, so, you know, it has modules, it's a framework, it allows, you know, to have, you know, install modules and you can just build the parts of your application that you need, but it has all the other stuff built in, like, you know, user account management, logging, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So that's the thing I'm really involved with, because it's already a very large project. Of course, it's on, you know, you can find it on GitHub. If you go to octane.org, it'll take you to, you know, the GitHub project. And, you know, it's just kind of a much larger community. So when you don't want to have to build your entire Blazor application from scratch, that's pretty much, you know, what you would, you know, a framework like Octane. So that's pretty much what I've been concentrating on, and I'll be speaking about it.
For people who don't know .NET Nuke, like, what are some of the, like, scenarios that this framework solves?
Yeah, because it kind of sounds like an old video game.
Yeah, exactly. Because it came, so originally it came from, you know, it was a play on PHP Nuke, which was simply this, you install this application, and it already has user management. It allows you to create pages through the web browser, but then you can install modules. So if you, for example, want a person to be able to take surveys, your visitors to take surveys, you just install the survey module. So Octane is the same way. So if you install Octane, you know, you have this thing goes, here's your Octane site. You log in, of course, as the administrator. You go to modules, and with Octane, they distribute the modules through NuGet. So you would see all these NuGet packages, and you would see, for example, the survey module. And you just click the button, and that survey module is installed in your site. And then you can configure it to, you know, put your survey questions in. You say, I want it on the main page. I want another instance on another page with different questions. I wrote that module, you know, published it to GitHub. But now you have this website which has surveys. Yet, what did you have to do? All you had to do was kind of install it. So that's what a framework, an application framework, such as the original .NET Nuke and now Octane, provides you. Like I said, the difference is that Octane is written in Blazor. So therefore, if you were to make custom modules, so, you know, this thing does everything you need, but, oh, I wanted to allow people to, you know, sign up for my seminars I have. So I have this, I want to make a custom seminar module. Okay, great, because you're now using Octane, you would write your module in Blazor, and there's a bunch of articles that I've written to show how you know, make your custom code into a module so that it can then install into your Octane site, and then you're done. So that's what an application
framework
does.
Would it be the type of
thing
where you could inherit from an existing module and then override a bunch of stuff, or is it more like, okay, here's the framework API, and like in that scenario, if you had something that did a lot of what you wanted it to do, but you needed to make a few tweaks to it?
Well, so for custom modules, you're pretty much supposed to talk to the framework API. If you, for example, go, oh, I want the survey module, but I want it to do a little bit more, you would just say, download my, or you would fork my GitHub project.
Gotcha.
You would then make your changes, obviously change the namespaces so it's your module so you don't conflict with you know, the version I created. And then upload it, and then you're good to go. So it just allows people to get from point A to point B faster, meaning you only have to write the code that you have to write. Everything else, you can probably just get modules and skinning and for the CSS layout and all that. You can get it from, you know, the community.
That's awesome. Michael, thanks so much for coming on today and sharing so much about Blazor and WebAssembly and kind of how this world works this, because it's been too long. We needed to get this episode out there for folks. And we all know that you're constantly at that on Twitter, and people should definitely check out your Twitter link. We'll drop it in the show notes. Michael's always talking about different ways to use Blazor and works with the team at Microsoft at times to work there. But to be very clear to everybody out there, WebAssembly is not a Microsoft thing. It's not a browser-specific thing. If you go to Can I Use, which we'll drop a link in the show notes, you can see where WebAssembly is and all the things you can do with it. We dropped in notes to the WebAssembly docs up on Mozilla is the place I generally go. Is that where you recommend to, Michael, for WebAssembly itself?
Oh, yeah. Yes, definitely. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so we dropped a bunch of notes out there, folks, to check these things out. Blazor is the... if you would say the flavor of WebAssembly, it's a flavor that's been made by Microsoft to work, in my words, ideally for folks who are C# experts or, you know, as practitioners of that, using ASP.NET, because a lot of the familiarities there kind of go along with it. And at the end of our show, Michael, what we'd like to do is leave our folks with a final thought out there. And this could be on topic or something else entirely. In the world that we all live in these days. And I will start today with Dan Wallin. Dan, what's your final thought for our audience?
My final thought is I love it when the internet works, but when it doesn't, it's not very fun.
Is that why you sound different? Because your internet died? And
I'm going to add to that thought and say, but how amazing is it I was able to jump to my phone and rejoin this and still continue on. But now, my quick thought is a lot of folks that are, this won't be Blazor related, but that are more in the JavaScript, TypeScript world are familiar with StackBlitz. And if you hadn't heard, they now have Next.js and Node.js and GraphQL options that you can do right on StackBlitz. So you can literally build Node apps right in the browser. And I won't go into, there's a blog post that Eric wrote up about it, who's behind all this, one of the guys behind it. Pretty amazing stuff, though, what they're doing with Node. But anyway, check it out, stackblitz.com, if you're interested.
That's a great point. Thanks for dropping that in there, Dan. Craig, Mr. Shoemaker, your internet didn't die, but what is your final thought today?
It did not. Grateful for reliable internet. From time to time when you're building an app, you might need to write a regular expression. And, you know, it's...
I feel like I've been seen, Craig.
Yes, as it is for all of ours. So there's a website, regx101.com. Whenever I have to write a regular expression, this is a tool that works really well for me. You put your text in, you can write your pattern. The neatest thing that I like about it, though, is that over on the right-hand panel, it gives you an opportunity to see your regular expression explained to you in somewhat that resembles plain English, and then also see the match information that comes out. And so, if you have to write a pattern, check it out. Maybe you make your life a little bit easier.
That is indeed the best part of that tool, because I'm laughing with Craig here because we're working on a project together, and I said, I will take any task except for writing the regex. So I handed that off to Craig. He's like, they're really not that hard.
Nice
I'm like,
guy, John. For you. You know, give your buddy the regex.
Like, that's that's showing the love, John. Yeah.
So I'll have two final thoughts here, I guess. The first one is know your strengths. And mine is not regex. So Craig, thank you so much for doing that piece. And the second piece is I work a lot with SVGs. And I'm no expert SVG in any way, shape, or form. So like Craig, when I need to work on SVGs or like a regex, I look for a site that helps me. And the site that I tend up on the most to build an SVG is called Boxy SVG. And I dropped a link in the show notes. It's a completely web-based editor. It's very simple to use. You don't have to know anything about SVGs to make it work. You basically just draw what you want, color it, style it, whatever. And then at the bottom pane, you can actually just copy and paste the SVG over to HTML or export it to a JPEG or ping if you need to. So anything you need, it's really nice. So Boxy SVG is the tool that I lean on when I'm needing some SVG help. Michael, what is your final thought for our listeners today?
My final thought is Steve Sanderson is a god and he's a genius. So I'm going to put his Twitter handle into the show notes. And I think everyone needs to follow his, because he will post things in GitHub where it'll be just pure genius and you're just staring at the code going, oh my God, I'm not worthy. So there, you will thank me. So I'm going to put that in the show notes.
Steve is, that's a one sharp guy, I'll tell you.
Yeah, and just as a reminder, because we did mention this earlier, Michael did, but Steve Sanderson also was the very modest creator of Knockout.js, which was one of my favorite frameworks back in the day as well.
We have stories there, John, from Germany. Remember, we won't go into it. Another show, maybe.
Yes, we do. I think it may even involve pitchforks and torches. But that will definitely be
I have not heard these yet.
Another episode. So definitely tune in when Dan and I talk about our adventures in Germany and also Heidelberg. We should talk about that as well. So, Michael, thank you again for coming on. And thank you, everybody, for joining our episodes. 140 episodes. I'm really, really honored that all of you would listen to us for a short time, if you're a first time listener or a long time through all these episodes. And thank you to our sponsors, AG Grid and Idea Blade and Narwhal, for continuing to keep us on the air. And of course, to our editor, Chris Enns, who has just done a great job with the podcast. So thank you all. And you'll see us every week next time, Thursday.